Peter Cooper. Just as the great ship of state, the Union Strong and Great, was launched, a little boy was born to delight the hearts of his humble parents, who, notwithstanding that the household was already a large one, made him doubly welcome. "For," said his father, "he comes into the world at the beginning of a new era. Thousands of opportunities will be open to him. Something tells me that his name will one day sound throughout the world." The mother smiled gently. She could not see that the babe differed in any way from any of his four brothers. "If he is as great a man as his soldier father, John Cooper," she said, "or his brave, noble grandfather, General John Campbell, who both won honorable spurs in the Revolution, I shall be satisfied." But the father insisted stoutly that the child's chances for distinction were many times greater, and that it would not be enough for him to do as well as his father and his grandfather. "He ought to go far beyond us," he said, "and he will. I feel that he is destined to be known of all men. Let us then give him a name which shall be truly fitting." What should it be? They could not decide, and the matter was left until the following evening. Then, as the sturdy hat maker walked slowly down the little street, which has now become Broadway, New York, he turned the great question over and over in his mind. What shall we name the baby? Suddenly, a voice seemed to come from the clear, starry sky. "Call him Peter," it said. The good man was deeply astonished. There was nothing remarkable about the name Peter, yet he did not doubt for an instant but that it was the name destined for his child. Neither did his loyal Scotch wife, who knew full well that there was such a thing as divine guidance. No doubt God had spoken. So the babe was christened Peter Cooper. Years passed. The little one grew and thrived like the hearty youngster that he was. But there was nothing to mark him a wonder child, unless it was that a special providence seemed to bring him safely through his countless mishaps. When only 4 years old, he climbed about the framework of a new house and fell, head downward, upon an iron kettle, cutting his forehead to the bone. Later on, he was accidentally cut with a knife in the hands of a playmate. Later still, he cut himself dangerously with an axe. Again, he fell from a high tree, holding an iron hook with which he had been reaching for cherry-bearing branches, and managed to hook out one of his teeth. At another time, he went for the nest of a hanging bird, and had the fact that it was a hornet's nest indelibly impressed on his memory. Of course, he was nearly drowned 3 times. Such youngsters always have such escapes. So you see, little Peter was all boy, full of adventure and courage which nothing could daunt. At school, young Peter never got much beyond the 3 R's. Those were strenuous times, and he was often obliged to lend a hand at home. There were 8 children besides Peter in the Cooper family, and the tired, overworked mother often pressed him into service about the house. He would cheerfully cook, wash, make beds, sweep, anything to help along. One of his useful inventions was a washing machine. His mother was delighted. Peter might yet prove a wonder child. If he could do one remarkable thing, he could do another. And so it proved. Peter's next triumph was a pair of shoes which he turned out secretly in odd moments. In the eyes of the Coopers, there wasn't a greater hero along the Hudson. One pair of shoes meant that shoes could be fashioned for 9 Cooper children, an item of great importance in those days when cobblers were few and expensive at best. The boy learned all about the hat-making business, but he had no desire to become a hatter. His parents had often told him how he was named, and he shared the belief that he would one day become great. He had been born into the world on the wings of a new country. George Washington had just taken his seat as the first president of the United States. Everyone felt that there was a glorious future ahead for the new republic. Surely there was somewhere a niche of usefulness for Peter Cooper. As his father had said, thousands of opportunities were open to him. He was to see a newborn nation grow into strength and greatness. Hamlets of his youth were to change into vast cities. Stagecoaches vanish before steam engines. Sailboats give way to steamboats. 1,000 circles of progress were to transpire, and the boy was to be part of it all. But this glimpse from one of his biographers carries us beyond our story. When Peter was still a small child, his family had removed to one of the old Dutch villages on the Hudson, and he spent many an hour up in an old apple tree, gazing across the valley to the purple peaks, beyond which lay the great world, and many and grand were the castles which he built concerning the time when he should be a man. First of all, he must be a financier, not because he cared about money particularly, but because he was certain he could not do a great amount of good without it. His first attempt, however, ended in disaster. He made a toy wagon, which he sold for $6. To this he added $4, hardly earned by odd jobs, and invested the whole in lottery tickets. He drew nothing but blanks, and for many days he mourned the loss of his small fortune with a heavy heart. But he learned the lesson. Never again did he attempt to make money at a game of chance. At length the time came when Peter was no longer needed at home, and he went to New York, hoping there to prove that there was something in his name of Peter after all. Shortly, he became apprentice to John Woodward, a coach builder at the corner of Broadway and Chambers Street. Here he was to receive $25 a year and board with his master, who was, of course, to teach him the trade of carriage making. It was interesting work, especially the ornamental wood carving, and young Peter soon proved himself both diligent and capable. He was delighted also to feel that fortune was with him, for he had been especially lucky in the choice of a kind master. Most of the apprentices about him led a sorry life. Many of their masters were hard and unfeeling and treated them little better than brutes. Not far away was King's College, and Peter often paused in his work to watch the sons of the rich cross College Square. They knew things he did not. The best lectures, the best music, the best libraries, the best colleges were everywhere ready to welcome and aid them. But there was no place for the greasy mechanic. As a class, they had no social standing. There were no night schools, no reading rooms, no free libraries or lectures open to them. Some day, the young man resolved, he would break this galling yoke of bondage and found a great school which should be free to the poor and friendless. But he formed no definite plans for doing this. He only knew that he must patiently work and strive until he had, in some way, managed to amass money enough to make himself a power. So he bent all his energies to his task, making several inventions for the betterment of his trade, and was altogether so honest and industrious that at the end of his 4 years of servitude, his grateful employer kindly offered to set him up in business. But Cooper dared not accept. The coach business depended on the whims of the rich, and there was no telling when an elegant and expensive vehicle might be left on his hands. He had a horror of imprisonment for debt, and this law was still in force. So he sought employment in a factory which made machines for shearing cloth. Here again, he took an active interest in the business, and in 3 years he had saved enough to patent his own device for shearing. The first purchaser of a county right for the machine was Mr. Vassar of Poughkeepsie, afterwards the founder of Vassar College. He paid the young inventor $500. This was Cooper's first real start in life and the foundation of the fortune he hoped one day to win. It is a strange coincidence when we remember that it was given to him by the gentleman whose name was to be linked with his in after years as a great benefactor of the young and friendless. Young Cooper now married and set about planning all sorts of inventions to make the household wheels run smoothly and with ease. His first child slept peacefully in a self-rocking cradle, which had a fan arrangement to drive away the flies, and a music box to soothe the infant with lullabies. Storm clouds never found a place beneath the Cooper roof, for the master possessed a serenity, a kindliness, seldom found with the inventive faculty. When he had become a white-haired old patriarch, his face was stamped with serenity and kindness to an unusual degree. He had the guileless look of innocent, happy childhood. One of his biographers said that some who saw old Peter Cooper and studied him at the age of 93 must have thought of the faraway little boy he once was. When the death knell sounded for his shearing machine, Cooper promptly turned his factory into a furniture store and sold it for what he could get. He next tried a grocery store, but the profits were too slow. He felt that he would never get enough money here to realize his purpose, so he bought a glue factory. To be sure, he knew nothing about the manufacture of glue, but he knew what a good glue ought to be, and he studied and experimented until shortly people began to talk of the excellence of Cooper's glue, and he had a ready market for all he could produce. During those first years, Cooper went to a factory at daybreak, kindled the fires, and spent the morning making glue. The afternoon was devoted to selling his product. Evenings, he kept his accounts, wrote, and read. Gradually, hard work, coupled with honest business methods and living always below his means, brought success. Cooper widened his business in several directions. He invested in land and dipped into the iron business, receiving the Bessemer Gold Medal from Great Britain in 1879 for his services in the development of the American iron trade. His inventions filled a long list and covered a wide field. Some of them were never placed in successful operation, but they could not be called entire failures. They contained the germs of future mechanical progress and spoke eloquently of his great vigor and genius. Among these may be mentioned the endless chain scheme for transporting canal boats and the invention of torpedo boats. He was the builder of the Tom Thumb, the first American locomotive. He conveyed freight in his ironworks at an early day by use of aerial cables. He was the first to use iron beams as a part of fireproof construction. Finally, the time came when Peter Cooper's name was indeed known far and wide. His immense rolling mills and glue factory gave employment to thousands of men. His coffers were filled with gold. He had become a power. He held in his hand the golden key necessary for the realization of his purpose. And he knew just what he wanted to do. He set blithely to work with as much enthusiasm as a boy of 16. Instead, he was a boy of 63. Years before, he had bought a lot at the junction of 3rd and 4th Avenues. Gradually, as he had the money, he had added to his purchase. Until now, he owned the whole block. And he knew just what sort of school he wished to found upon it. It was to be a union of arts and trades, after the fashion of the school founded in Paris by the first Napoleon. So in 1854, the cornerstone of that noble structure, the Cooper Union, was laid in the building dedicated forever to the union of art and science and their application to the useful purposes of life. The building, which stands today, practically unchanged, cost better than $500,000. There is a library of more than 20,000 volumes. The best papers and magazines are on its tables. 1,500 persons come daily to the comfortable reading rooms. On Saturday nights, the great hall, with a seating capacity for 2,000 people, is thrown open for free lectures on a variety of subjects interesting to the working classes. The very best instructors are employed to teach engineering, drafting, drawing, chemistry, natural philosophy, painting, telegraphy, etc. Day and night, the doors of this great institution, which is kept up at a cost of over $50,000 per year, stands open wide for all who care to enter. Here, hundreds and thousands of poor boys and girls of all classes, creeds, and races have received the benefit of the labors of a little country lad who was once himself a slave of toil and knew the pathos of the cry, "Oh, if I only had an education." For nearly 30 years, it was Mr. Cooper's delight to drive to the Institute daily and witnessed the earnest students hard at work, making the most of their opportunities. He had a keen eye for the needy, and many a stranded one found food as well as education at the hands of Grandpa Cooper. Nothing pleased him more than to bring some struggling girl or woman to his school where they might be made self-supporting. Mothers with families of little ones on their hands found in him a tower of strength. Often he was known to provide a day nurse for some poor, frail washerwoman or charwoman, that she might go to the institution and learn some trade better fitted to her strength. The name of Peter Cooper soon became a watchword in countless households throughout the length and breadth of the land. People spoke of him as the best-loved man in America. Whenever he appeared on the streets in his little old-fashioned carriage, cabmen and carters of every description would respectfully touch their caps and give him the right of way. The story is told that when Edward Cooper was nominated for mayor of New York, people who did not know him said, "He is the son of Peter Cooper, therefore he must be a good man. I will vote for him." Peter Cooper's great soul passed from the earth April 4, 1883. Early on the morning of his funeral, his body was placed in All Souls Unitarian Church. Here a mighty multitude thronged in procession to take a last look at his kindly face. 18 young men from the Cooper Union formed the guard of honor. 3,500 students from the institution passed by in a body, casting flowers upon the casket. Delegations from all the organizations of the city followed, and after them came the vast population who honored his remains simply because of their personal love. When his body was borne down Broadway, a miracle happened. The great noisy avenue was as still and silent as the grave which was soon to hold the loved remains of the people's dearest friend. Not a person or a vehicle of any description marred the broad street. It was a beautiful tribute to the quiet, peace-loving, kindly man whose life was in such a full measure what a noble life should be. The streets along the route were draped in black. All the public buildings and the ships in the harbor held their flags at half-mast. The church bells tolled, and all the city mourned, as it had not done since 80 years before, when the body of the father of our country was borne through its streets. Such a man as Peter Cooper needs no monument to keep his name from being forgotten, for it is immortal. It will go down the centuries with a bright halo of unfading glory. His success must ever stand as an example of what one may accomplish by having a purpose. For this was the ladder upon which the great philanthropist mounted. Upon it, he bent all his energies, and he never swerved one jot either to the right or left, but kept on in a straight course, saying always to himself, "Higher, forever higher." The course which he followed is open to all who wish to enter it. There is nothing to hinder any boy or girl from beginning at the foot of the ladder, as he did, and climbing upward by his own strength of character until they reach the highest round. Honor and glory forevermore to this great man gone to rest. Peace on the dim plutonium shore. Rest in the land of the blessed. I reckon him greater than any man that ever drew sword in war, nobler, better than king or khan, better, wiser by far. Aye, wisest he in this whole wide land of hoarding till bent and gray, for all you can hold in your cold, dead hand is what you have given away. Joaquin Miller.